south of the border, down Mexico way. That's where I fell in love when the stars above came out to play. And now as I wander.
Hello there, all you expat wannabes. I'm Johnny Mueller, and you're listening to The Expat Files, Living in Latin America, the show that tells you just what it's like to live, work, play, and or retire down here in Latin America. It's a mix of the good, the bad, the ugly, and the great, and it's all right here, so let's get started.
All right, let's start out the show today talking about expats and gringos who are not happy. Gringos and expats who've made the Plan B transition, and for whatever reason or reasons, it's not working out for them. Hey, you can't please everyone, right? Well, let's start out with this email from Estuardo. I think you'll find this really enlightening. He says, "Dear Johnny, a few shows ago, you outlined the reality that there will always be a certain number of unhappy expats and gringos, people who are never happy or satisfied, even after they've gotten out of Dodge, a place they disliked, even hated, and have settled into a new place, which they soon start to dislike or even hate." As Ernie Hemingway once said, one man's tropical paradise is another man's sweaty, bug-infested gulag. He ought to know, he lived in Cuba pre-Castro. So, Johnny, I'd like to double down on that theme with my personal story and all the unhappy expats I've come across in Panama. That's where I've lived all my life, except for my college years up in the States. As for me, Johnny, I'm one of those Latinos you make fun of once in a while. I'm an educated, bilingual, Latino real estate broker. You're probably wondering why my English is so good. Well, I'm one of those entitled kids of the rich, as you might say. The ones you like to pick on. Hey, you can't choose your parents, right? Then he says, "So I had the opportunity of attending so-called helicopter schools all my life. Anyway, my real estate office is located in a little colonial town that abuts Panama City. And during my 10 years in business, I've sold or rented to at least 120 foreigners, mostly gringos. I even married one, but we'll save that story for another time. As you might expect, all these people brought their hopes and dreams to my country. They came excited to make a new life for themselves. And the vast majority have flourished. They built businesses, started families, made friends, and in some cases, made a fortune. They've engineered a special lifestyle for themselves they could never have had back in their home countries, and they freely admit that. And most of them, I'd say 80% of them, will never return to their home countries except for a visit. They're now what I call hyphenated Panamanians. But what about that never satisfied 20%, the ones that regretted their decision to move? Obviously, Panama, or their dream of Panama, did not live up to their expectations. Funny thing, though, every foreigner who ends up here is subject to the same conditions as everyone else. So why do some foreigners thrive while others become frustrated, burnt out, and eventually leave? As for me, I have both personal and professional reasons for wanting to figure out or be better able to predict who would transition successfully and who would fail. Boy, if there was a simple quiz for a would-be expat to take that could predict all that, now there's a million-dollar idea. Obviously, predicting that would alleviate lots of grief for me. Unhappy clients are bad for business and bad for referrals. And part of a realtor's role, like mine, is to help clients make the right decisions for themselves and get on with their lives and take it from there. But in my case, it's even more personal than that. Living in a small historic district like ours, clients are your neighbors, and your neighbors are your friends, or they're supposed to be. You want everyone to be happy, right? It's sad. You feel bad. To see someone slowly burn out and become frustrated, knowing at some level they relied on you to make that decision, a huge decision in their life, is a heavy burden. When expats fail, I feel a little bit of that failure myself. So over the years, I've been meditating on the question and analyzing case by case the happy and the unhappy expats I have dealt with. Then he says, "As I did, I began to see some certain patterns emerging. It's nothing scientific and probably wouldn't be since you can never really know 100% what's going on in someone's mind. But it's given me some insights to help me better counsel future clients, even spot early on the ones I think will or won't make it." The question does arise, are all unhappy expats alike in certain ways? Well, one thing I know for sure, happy families, anyway, have their own special little chemistry that keeps them together despite the ups and downs and traumas of life. And when I look back on my list of the hundreds of expats I've known, it's much easier now, years later, to see the patterns amongst the ones who left. In other words, it's easier to figure out the failures than the successes. Not that there aren't lots of lessons to learn from the happy expats I've known. It's just that there are fewer things that I would consider predictors. That is, predictors of growing unhappiness in certain expats. Now, it may be a cliche to say that the cause of unhappiness amongst expats is that they were simply unhappy people to begin with, who somehow convinced themselves that getting away from it all, getting a plan B, getting out of Dodge, and starting over in a new place would bring them true happiness. Seems to me these types have never known true happiness before. A lot of them were chronically miserable, unhappy, and negative people before they even came down. Like the guy who plays the lottery every week thinking winning a million will finally make him happy, while history proves it almost never does. So now I become very attuned to expats I first meet, and sometimes in the very first minutes of the conversation, who quickly dive into stories of how unfair life has been to them. That's a red flag. When you start conversing with people and they give you a list of complaints and the broken relationships they've had, etc., how they insist that a brand new start and a new move will make them happy, that just doesn't wash, because some people are happy just sitting in prison. Why is it that the majority of deaf or blind people, deformed people, poor people, even Eskimos who've never seen a flower or a blade of grass, they're happy? Of course, a certain amount of money can make you less stressed or more content. But once a person makes about $75,000, the effect levels off. And down here in Panama and the rest of Latin America, all you need is about a quarter of that to get the same effect. My advice, though, when I first meet a person and I hear them start to complain about all the tragedy in their life back home, I mostly think they don't need to come to Panama. I think they need counseling or a shrink. The other thing is, if you're on the verge of a nervous breakdown because you hate everything about where you live right now or hate everything about your situation, moving to a developing country like Panama is probably the worst thing you can do. If you're really on the edge and sort of falling apart, you need a predictable, stable environment where you can focus on yourself and work through your issues and repair your relationships. You don't need to come down to a place where you really don't know anyone and have no network or relationships whatsoever. Then he says, in my experience, fresh newbie gringos have an idealized conception of the tropics as more laid back, less regulated, less stressful, etc., etc. It's all that for sure and mostly true. But it can take a long while before you settle in and realize the benefits of all that. Just imagine the first time you go to a gas station and you don't speak any Spanish. That's just pumping gas. What if it's something complicated, like you need a brake job? How smooth is that going to go? If you don't have a good network in the early days, your first couple of years will be tough. You'll get knocked around, maybe even ripped off a few times. Dealing with Latin Americans on a day-to-day basis will challenge your assumptions of what's logical, fair, and right. Certain things are done differently in Latin America. There will be things that aggravate you. Mañana time, standing in lines, plumbers and electricians not showing up at your dentist appointment only to find out the doctor took the day off. As a result, if you're not very comfortable in your own skin and don't have a good coping mechanism, or if you're just a little neurotic and anal to begin with, certain irritating day-to-day events here will make you more nuts than you are already. Next, Johnny, I find the second most common reason for unhappy expats, in my experience, is that they get themselves into financial trouble. This goes right back to a few things you discussed on your show before. Namely, you have to have some months' working capital set aside once you open your business, because it's rarely Grand Central Station the moment you open your doors. As one gringo who failed in business put it, he says, the best way to become a millionaire in Latin America is to bring $2 million down with you. Of course, that's extreme hyperbole, but it is well known that most new businesses fail within the first 2 years, and almost always due to lack of reserve capital. It's therefore astounding to me how many people move to Panama and put their life savings at risk, starting a business in an industry they don't know much about but always had that as a dream, like, for example, a restaurant or a hotel. Still, they have that dream and they try to do it in a place they don't speak the language, don't know the customs, or have personal networks. As you've said before, Johnny, so many would-be expats have the dream of starting a business in Latin America, though they've never really been down before and got real boots on the ground. One of the riskiest things you could do is make your entire business plan for that bar, restaurant, or mom-and-pop hotel while sitting up there in your home office in Chicago or New York. Almost all of the successful expat businesses I know were generated from good, solid ideas that came from boots-on-the-ground experiences. I know plenty of new gringo expats who convinced themselves that opening a bar or restaurant in a tropical paradise like Panama would allow them to have the enviable picture-perfect life, no matter if they never actually owned a bar or restaurant before. And ladies, just because everybody compliments your Thanksgiving turkey or your Christmas lasagna that does not necessarily translate to success in the restaurant business. Here in Panama, anyway, very few expats find success in a business they conjured up or had their hearts set on before they ever moved down. It rarely works that way. You have to get boots on the ground, do your homework, and have a cushion of time and capital. Otherwise, you're very likely to find yourself an unhappy expat. For a good reason. You'll be broke. However, I must point out, of the 30 or so expats I've seen who've opened businesses, only a few have failed. And I think it boils down to the fact, like you said, Johnny, that expats often come in with insights, ideas, and improvements that the local businessmen just don't recognize. For example, their ability to size up and beat the competition, being able to gauge where the market's heading. For example, the intangible business concepts and ideas expats seem to bring with them can often more than make up for any local unknowns. If expats have a decent idea and enough capital to stick it out long enough, they normally do fine. Some even get rich. It's my advice, he says, if you want to dabble in a side business to see how it goes, great. Don't go all in on one big roll of the dice. Funny thing, though, when that happens, and it sometimes does, those disappointed expats don't blame themselves, they blame the country. And when they get home, they write a nasty blog about it. Then he says, although the two previous reasons account for almost all of the unhappy expats I've seen, there's yet another small group of expats that remain unhappy. Those are expats with unrealistic expectations. Those are people who want Panama or any other place in Latin America to be something that it just isn't. And when they realize they can't change it, they refuse to adjust and adapt and become unhappy just because they feel they've been betrayed somehow. Why not? If naivety and gullibility are legitimate excuses, then that feeling's often justified because there's an unlimited amount of propaganda floating around on the internet selling Panama as a species of tropical paradise that's without equal in the world. International Living pumped up Panama for years as the world's number one foreign retirement destination, only to get replaced by Ecuador, then Colombia. It's good for International Living clickbait numbers, but it can't be right. Something's wrong with that picture. If you're expecting an International Living-style paradise, pretty much anything that really exists in this world is going to disappoint you. Then he says, in the end, I've learned to listen to two words when speaking with expats. Words should and ought. If someone recently arrives in Panama and frequently mentions that Panama should or ought to do this, I'll bet money that that person will soon be an unhappy expat. And whether or not they are correct on their observations, which they very well may be, the fact is they are focused on how things should be, but not how they actually are. Oddly enough, they want things to be more like they are up in their own hometown, rather than trying to understand what they're like here. And it tells me they probably don't have the necessary coping skills that they'll need to deal with an imperfect tropical paradise. Though the word paradise sounds awful good, no one ever said it equals the word perfect. In other words, inflexible complainers need not apply. Then he says, interestingly enough, I have found that quite often things that expats think should be done would create exactly the circumstances that they say they didn't like in their home country and one of the reasons why they left. A typical and common case is when expats find out there is no real cause of action for negligence here. There's no one to sue. You trip on a stair, you fall down in a parking lot, your car drops in a Volkswagen-sized pothole or into an opening where there used to be a manhole cover. The first thing an expat thinks is that they ought to be entitled to compensation. They need payback or someone to sue. When they arrive in Panama, they claim they hate lawyers. They despise the litigiousness of the U.S. system. Almost all expats, even ones that were lawyers back where they came from, claim that. That is, until their car hits that drainage ditch with no markings. The key to happiness here in Panama or anywhere in Latin America is focusing on the positive and the things you can change in your own environment and let the rest go. As an expat, it's important to have a cultural intuition of how the locals handle things. Let them roll with it like they always have. If you have a better way of doing things, good for you. But don't try to force it on the locals. Try to develop a curiosity that helps you understand why things are the way they are and why the local people prefer things that way. Though it's true, even the locals occasionally complain. They get into that should and ought to business. Most times it's about their government, and justifiably so. But going there too often is a surefire way to make yourself miserable, no matter where you are. That's why I think it's a big mistake when gringos start gathering regularly at those gringo bars, those expat bars. It's a good way for a new expat to get contaminated or tainted. You can always get yourself into a should or ought to discussion there. Again, try not to be a regular add an expat bar. It's not good for your health, physical or mental. And before I forget, one last thing about expats. They like to live in gated, guarded communities, among other English-speaking gringos, of course. Being into real estate, I can speak knowledgeably on that subject firsthand. However, guarded gates can turn into walls, and walls can turn into your own private prison if you let them. Oh, and don't get me started on expats and their social media addictions. You don't have to be a pimply 16-year-old to be addicted to Facebook, Instagram, Twaddle, or TikTok. I know many gray-haired gringos with walkers who stare at their phones all day. And speaking of retired expat gringos who are basically shut-ins, that is, shut-in to their gated guarded compounds. Sure, they occasionally venture out to Walmart or Costco, but does that sound like golden retirement tropical paradise living to you? That's my rant, Johnny. Keep the shows coming. I haven't missed one in a long time. And he signs it LIC period Estuardo A. By the way, if you're not in the know about that little prefix, LIC period or LICA period, the LIC period is short for licenciado, and LICA period is short for licenciada. It means that person's got a bachelor degree. He's proud and he's letting you know about it. Yeah, that's right, here in Latin America, college degrees are quite rare, even bachelor's degrees. You know, in the States, 40% of adults have a bachelor's degree. In Latin America, around 3%. So, getting a bachelor's degree down here is a real big thing. In fact, I run into Latin Americans all the time who say, I was the very first kid in my family to go to college. That reminds me how it was back in the States in the 60s and 70s. Same thing. Though there are tons of Latin Americans going to college, especially the public colleges, because they're free. But only a very small percentage graduate. In fact, in Guatemala City, they have this public university called USAC, University of San Carlos. It's a huge public campus with over 100,000 students enrolled. But the fact is, less than 10% of them ever graduate with a bachelor's degree. Oh, and by the way, when you think of the name of that gigantic public university, the University of San Carlos, you have to realize there's no separation of church and state. San Carlos in English means St. Charles. So they've got a public university in many of them named after saints. That also gives you an idea how weak or even non-existent the cancel culture is down here. Just imagine it by you if there was a public school named after a saint. How long would that last? Well, it would have never gotten off the ground in the first place. Anyway, those two prefixes, licenciada and licenciado, masculine and feminine. Nothing gender fluid about it. It's either masculine or feminine. That's the way the Spanish language is. Come to think of it, where are those wokesters and cancel culture dickheads when you need them? I mean, where are they when you need to punch someone in the face? Well, you won't find them down here in Latin America. Isn't that a shame? Except, and when you figure, in gringo tourist areas and in certain gated, guarded communities on the gringo tourist trail with a large contingent of expats. But I digress as usual. All right, changing gears a second here. You know, I never use Google as my search engine. Google is the incarnation of internet evil. Remember a couple of shows back, we mentioned a guy was on Joe Rogan, an expert on uncovering the dirt on Google, how he totally unshelled that rotten egg in front of a huge audience of something like 10 million people. If you're interested in that show, send me an email, theexpatfiles@gmail.com, and I'll send you the link. I do guarantee you, after you've heard just 10 minutes of that show, you'll never use Google again. It'll make you sick just thinking about all the times you used it in the past. However, then people say, well, if I don't use Google, what do I use as a search engine? Well, I've been using for years now startpage.com, and lots of other people use DuckDuckGo. You've heard of that before. However, now we've just found out during this Ukraine war business, DuckDuckGo has been caught pulling a Google, censoring information, and inhibiting the natural search process if you plug something in. So I guess that puts DuckDuckGo on the Google feces list too. But startpage.com, still pure of heart and hanging in there. Let's see for how long. By the way, speaking of how really screwed up things are up in the first world, especially the United States, you know, every day I get emails from people telling me another sordid story about some big brother abuse, whether it's mandates, human rights, whatever. Every day life's getting crazier and tougher up there. Just wait till your gas is 10 bucks a gallon. Now, the funny thing is, you're never a hero when you're ahead of the curve. I remember back in the 60s when my Uncle Bernie said, start saving those silver quarters, dimes, and half dollars in your pocket change and hide them away. And when you get older, you'll be a rich guy. He explained the world's monetary system was being debased, falling apart. My uncle kept saying, runaway inflation will come and your only hope is to save silver. Well, that was in the 60s. His own family members thought he was nuts. Till 40 years later, when all the silver he saved was now worth millions. And suddenly, the eccentric alarmist was a clairvoyant genius, but it took 40 years. Then came the late 70s. My engineering buddies and I used to have discussions about how Social Security had to go bankrupt. There'd be nothing left but IOUs by the time we got around to collecting. So we made a pledge to ourselves never to count on Social Security, always to have another source of retirement income when the time comes. Meanwhile, the non-engineering personnel at our company thought that notion was eccentric. We were alarmists, a little nuts. Uncle Sam would never let that happen. Social Security was a sacred trust. He wouldn't leave the old codgers high and dry, the ones that had been paying in all those years. Then came the 1980s and a book called The Grace Report, a detailed report on all the waste and failures in government. It was a shock to see that 30 to 50 million Americans were on some kind of government assistance. Food stamps, Medicaid, Medicare, housing allowances, more than 100 different government welfare programs. We thought, that is my more intelligent buddies and I, the government has to crash and burn. This can't go on. Where's the money coming from? But they managed to keep the snowball rolling. And in the 90s, we found out just how much it cost to run 150 different embassies worldwide, 1,000 different military bases, plus the cost of a couple of never-ending wars. Oh, and let's not forget about that estimated $1 trillion for the black budget. Meanwhile, my more intelligent buddies and I would say to each other, this just can't last. It's got to crash and burn. Where's the money coming from? Wrong again. How about all those billions lost in those Medicaid and Medicare scams? You hear all the time about doctors and hospitals scamming Medicare and Medicaid for tens of millions of dollars. And then there's all those personal stories of government waste and fraud. Everyone's got a friend or a friend of a friend who'll tell you a story or two about some government waste and fraud on a local or state level. I saw plenty of scams like that when I was working for the street department way back when, during my college summer breaks. You regular listeners heard me talk about that illustrious job I had at the Chicago Street Department when I was on the dead dog crew. Except for the smell and the maggots, it was a pretty good job. Yep, those were the days. Now, as far as government waste, scams, and fraud, we've all read and heard about most of them by now, right? And each time you hear of a new one, you say to yourself, or at least I do anyway, how much longer could this go on? I still can't understand for the life of me why the U.S. government has not degenerated into Venezuela. Though it is on its way, you've probably figured out by now, I'm not very good at predicting time frames. So then why am I bringing all this up? What's it got to do with Latin America? Well, those of you who've been paying attention to my brother and his stem cell journey here in Latin America. Well, after making quite a few visits down here in the past year or so, he's decided he's had it with the U.S. He wants to get the hell out of Dodge, too. He's starting his plan B and moving to Latin America. Funny thing, too, even though he's been down here a number of times and he's learned a lot from me, he still said to me, just recently too, with my pension, Social Security, and disability, I'll be making over $4,000 a month when my Social Security kicks in. He keeps asking me, he must have said it 5 times, do you think that's enough to live okay in Latin America? And I keep shaking my head. $4,000 a month down here puts you in the stratosphere of income earners, and he's single. And I can tell he's nervous about it, since $50,000 a year up in Chicago, or anywhere else up in the States, just barely gets you above the poverty level. Anyway, up by you on $50,000 a year, you'll never be able to get ahead. Now, remember how just earlier in the show, I was talking about the tremendous prevalence of government waste and fraud that's been going on for dozens and dozens of years now. And how people who look at this stuff critically and do the calculations keep thinking, why hasn't the whole system crashed and burned already? How can this keep going on? Anyway, just when we thought we've heard every government scam in the book, or at least I thought I had, my brother, our stem cell poster child, just informed me of a government scam he was involved in, and it continues to go on. I thought, I gotta tell this one on the show. And I know when you hear this one, you're gonna say, damn, how is that possible? Well, it's like this. My brother retired after 20 years at a huge meat packing plant just outside of Chicago. It was a plant that provided all the toxic meat patties for McDonald's, Wendy's, Burger King, etc. That's where my brother developed a lot of his physical conditions. He had to quit because he was in and out of sub-zero freezers and back into room temperature places 20 or 30 times a day. And his many sports injuries and surgeries just couldn't hack it. So anyway, he took early retirement, got bored, and decided to get another job. He got a job in maintenance at the county sheriff's department. Of course, he got on the county health insurance plan. That's free, you know, when you're an employee. It was called Humana, H-U-M-A-N-A, insurance. Now, this is a huge insurance company that's partially owned and funded by government. And insurance companies know that if you're physically fit, you're not going to put in many claims, right? So the company instituted a physical fitness goal for all the thousands of people on the plane. They gave everyone, including my brother, a pedometer that counted the number of steps you took a day. And if you took 5,000 steps, that was normal. But with 10,000 or more, you'd earn points. And at the end of the quarter, those points would accumulate, and you'd be able to go to Amazon and buy things with those accumulated points. In fact, my brother said the first couple of months he was there, he was able to buy a gas grill, a computer, and some other stuff worth way over $1,000. By the way, he said you could turn those points into cash money too. Anyway, then I said, because I didn't quite believe it, how could you possibly get 10,000 steps in a day? You can barely walk 2 blocks with those two terribly shot knees of yours. Well, he said one of his buddies in the maintenance department said you take the pedometer and you strap it on any metal part out of the riding mower. You start cutting the grass and it'll spin out of control. Then he said this guy told him that the girls and guys in the office who sat all day, they'd strap it on their ankle and continuously tap their foot. And after a few hours of that, they'd have 10,000 steps too. Now, if you had restless leg syndrome, you'd really be in luck. Me, Johnny here. You know, I have that. By the way, that's been recently designated as a disorder. Funny how when I was a kid, if you bounced your leg, you were just considered a little restless. Now, where were we? Oh, yeah. How to cheat the pedometer for cash and prizes. So the guy at work told my brother, at night at home, all you got to do is strap it onto a power drill, rev it up, and it goes crazy too. So here you have thousands and thousands of people scamming an insurance company, basically the government, because they're paying for it. Each of them getting thousands of dollars worth of awards and prizes from Amazon. That makes anyone who's got half a brain think once again, how much longer can this last? Why hasn't the system crashed and burned? Oh, and by the way, my brother tried to get disability for years for his arthritis, his bad joints, for his vertigo and night terrors and all the other crap that's gone wrong with him. But it seemed he just couldn't qualify until a guy at work told him to go apply again, but to say the magic words, quote, I tried to commit suicide. Yep, those are the magic words. I tried to commit suicide. And man, almost instantly, you get on disability. Before doing that, the guy advised, you must call a suicide hotline at least once. There has to be a record of it, just for a little documented proof. Which again begs the question, why hasn't the whole system just crashed and burned? Man, am I glad I'm living in Latin America.
South of the border. You've been listening to The Expat Files, Living in Latin America. If you need some help with your own Plan B, we can schedule a one-on-one phone or Skype consult. Just send me an email, theexpatfiles@gmail.com. And if you want to get on the waiting list for my next week-long Expat Insider Seminar in Central America, where you're guaranteed to get a 2 to 5 year head start on your Plan B, send me an email, theexpatfiles@gmail.com. Nos vemos.